All of that is biblical womanhood. Every message, really, that comes from a pulpit is about biblical womanhood. Why? Because it is about the universal truth for God's people who include women, and women are supposed to apply them. Therefore, it is shaping biblical women. Every message is about biblical womanhood because biblical womanhood should be exactly that, biblical. Biblical. Now, you might say, well, can you be more specific and more specialized toward women in application? Sure, and people, when they think of the Old Testament, of course, the passage, the go-to passage, is Proverbs 31. We understand that. And then you read Proverbs 31, and you have some questions. One is, hey, this is really profound, and Proverbs 31 has an air of sophistication because it's at the end of the book of Proverbs and imbibing all this different wisdom, and it's really wisdom personified in a way. And so you think, okay, that's a lot of complexity. Can we simplify it down? And so you say, well, can I do what Proverbs 31 says? And you look at what the Proverbs 31 woman says and does, and you say, how is that possible? You know, that's a really discouraging message. Can we be a little bit more uplifting? And on top of that, people wonder, can you make it a little more concrete? What does this really look like in real life? Because this looks completely unrealistic. So can we just see a person doing this? And the answer to all of those questions is, yeah, it's Ruth. It's Ruth. And you say, how do you know that? Because the Bible tells me so. Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. Turn there with me. Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. It starts talking about Boaz. He's a man of excellence. That's what you see in chapter 2, verse 1. But if you keep going down through this passage, oh, and the reason I want to point out excellence is that word excellence, it matters a lot. It matters a lot. It's already introducing a theme of this book, the theme of excellence. But there's a reason for why this word is introduced. And if you keep reading through Ruth 2 and you keep seeing her, Ruth 3:11, look at it now. Now, my daughter, it says, Boaz, do not fear all that you say I will do for you. For all my people within the gates of the city know, notice what the next phrase, that you are a woman of excellence. That's what it says. And you say, my translation doesn't say that. Well, the Legacy Standard Bible that Jason translated does. Woman of excellence. And you say, why does it mean a woman of excellence? Well, there's two reasons for that. Reason one is because that's what it says in the Hebrew Bible. But two, here's the bonus if you get it consistent and get it right. Have you heard what it says in Proverbs 31? An excellent woman who can find. Yes? It's the exact same phrase. It's the exact same phrase. You could put it this way. In the ultimate inspiration of God, what Proverbs 31 in part was aiming for was who Ruth was. And what Ruth was, she was the embodiment. She was the exemplification of the Proverbs 31 woman. In fact, you could put it this way. In the Hebrew Bible, which has a different book ordering than our Protestant English Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, its book ordering, Ruth comes right after Proverbs. Why? Even though it just frustrates the daylights out of seminary students because you can't find anything, the reason it happens this way is because if you want to meet Mrs. Proverbs 31, just flip the chapter, just flip the page, and you have Ruth. They all understood this. They all understood this. So if you want to understand a Proverbs 31 woman, if you want to have a concrete reality of a Proverbs 31 woman, if you want to see what does this really look like and what coheres it all together, just look at the life of Ruth. And it's not because Chow said so. It's because our Bible said so. Our Bible told us that. And in light of this, I want to then provide four characteristics about a godly woman from Ruth. Four characteristics. You say, how do you get four? Well, how many chapters are there in Ruth? Four. This isn't rocket science. Okay? And so let's look at four characteristics of a godly woman. Now, I know what typically happens, or at least typically happens in my heart. So maybe you are so much more godly than myself. Praise God for that. I am so grateful if that is the case. And so if you are a guy like me and we are talking about biblical womanhood, you just kind of say, I can relax. This is for them out there. I don't have to listen to this. Yeah, I'll just get ready for next week, but not this week. I can chill. No, you can't, for several reasons. One is this. When we talk about biblical womanhood, what did we say? It's all about what the Bible says. So this applies to women, and as you're going to see, you're going to say, well, actually, it applies to men too. Yeah, that's the point. There is a universality here. And not only that, here's a second thing. As we will talk about as we get into this, if you are pursuing a woman, don't you want to know the kind of woman you should pursue? So many people come up to me and like, what's a godly woman? It's too late if you're asking me that and you're trying to find one because your emotions have distorted everything. Learn it before you get into the situation. And third, you might say, well, I already got a godly woman. Good. Then maybe you should learn what is so valuable about her. And meditate on that, and when there is opportunity, which there probably is every single day, remind her and tell her and convey to her and give thanks to God for her about these truths. So men, you can't chill during this sermon. You just can't. This is for all the church. There is a reason why this is all here. It has application to all of us. And so what makes a godly woman a godly woman? What is biblical womanhood? Here's the first characteristic, commitment to God. Commitment to God, that's chapter 1. And there is the famous phrase, the powerful, powerful phrase, Ruth declares. She says, not only your people shall be my people, verse 16, but here's the key phrase, and your God, my God. Your God, my God. This is a powerful, powerful declaration. And to really understand its power, and to really understand its significance and profundity, we do need some context. First and foremost, we understand that in the book of Ruth, that it reminds us that there was great tragedy. That Naomi and her husband went out from Judah because of a great famine in God's judgment upon the land, and that judgment continued even chastening and disciplining their own life as husbands died. Not only husbands died, but sons died. And so there's all this death, and all you have is Naomi with her two daughters-in-law. And a great tragedy leads to even greater questions. And the greater question is this, that Naomi urges her daughters-in-law, to leave her, to return home. And you have to listen to this very carefully. Verses 8 and 9 of chapter 1. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each of you to her mother's house. May Yahweh show kindness with you as you have shown the dead and with me. Sounds good so far. May, verse 9, Yahweh grant that you might find rest. Each in the house of her husband. Now think about this. Where are their husbands? They're dead. So what has Naomi actually said in a kind of clever way? I hope you die. Go die. Go find rest in peace. R.I.P. Die. When Naomi says, I'm bitter, she is bitter. For real. This isn't just a spiritual thing to say. She's Mara because she is bitter. And you can hear it here. You can hear it here. But this bitterness is for a reason. It is because it is real. Because Naomi knows she can't provide her daughters-in-law with a husband. Return, my daughters, verse 11. Why should you go with me? Have I sons in the womb that they may be your husbands? I can't provide a husband for you. And even if I could provide a husband for you, he's going to be a little baby and you can't wait that long to have a husband. Naomi, if she was responding to my allegation that she's bitter, she would say both that she is bitter But she's not a pessimist. She's a realist. She's just a very bitter realist. And this becomes a question. Why would somebody stay not only with a bitter woman, but in those kinds of terrible circumstances? It can't be because of cultural convention. Naomi already sent them off. It can't because it's a pragmatic, good strategy decision. Naomi's already debunked that. Why would you stay? There has to be a deeper reason. In fact, this has to be a worldview reason. It has to be, in a way, a convictional reason. It has to be a reason about your heart. Great tragedy produces very great questions. And Naomi knows this. She even hints at this. Look at what the text says. Verse 15, behold, your sister-in-law, she's talking to Ruth here, has returned to her people, and what is the next phrase? And her gods. Naomi knows, the only reason you would ever come with me is because you don't have your pagan gods. You have a different god. That's the only reason. You can't say because of culture. Naomi already debunked that. You can't say because it's a practical strategic move. It's a promotional move. No, it doesn't do that at all. Naomi already debunked that. There's only one reason you would do it. It's because you have a God who demands it, who treasures that, who prizes that. Orpah does not. So she left. She left. But what does Ruth say? Your God is what? Is my God. Your God is my God. She stays, not because it's culturally acceptable, not because it's culturally permissible or even virtuous. She stays not merely because it has some kind of practical benefit or advantage. She stays because theology in her heart and newly formed doctrine given by the work of the Spirit in her life demands it. That's what's going on here. And everything in verses 16 and 17 is actually framed around the center of your God, my God. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, my people. Your God, my God. You die, I die. There I will be buried. That Yahweh may do this to me and more if anything but death separates you and me. Notice in verses 16 and 17, all of these phrases, they are all around the center. And the center is your God, my God. Everything is expressing what does it mean that Ruth is committed to the God of Israel so. And so, what does it mean then? What does it mean that Ruth is that committed to God? So committed that it drives her to stay with Naomi. Let me give you some insights here. One, it means that she committed her entire existence to God. It means that she committed her entire existence to God. Notice the first phrase of verse 16. Where you go, what? I will go. This is a massive statement. Think about it from Ruth's perspective. Think about what it entails for Ruth in her physical life. It means this. She's going to follow who? Naomi. Every single experience Naomi has, every single situation, every single circumstance, she, that is, Ruth, has relinquished. She has said, all of that I give to God. That's the entire existence. And more than that, think about this. What Ruth gave up at this moment is her personal choice. She no longer sets the direction of her life. She no longer sets where they go. She no longer sets what she experiences. Why? Who is actually going to set that? Naomi, in the providence of God. And all of that is driven because Ruth has given herself to God. You know, sometimes we say, oh, I'm here to follow Christ. Do we really understand what that means? Often, what we mean by I will follow Christ is actually Christ will follow me. I will do what I want to do. I will go where I want to go. I have a direction. I have a strategy. I have a track. And Jesus should support me in whatever I want. And you say, how can you prove that in my life? Just watch how you pray. Just watch how you pray. Lord, I want to do this. Help me. Who's following who then? Who's following who? Who's directing who? We keep saying, I want to follow after Christ. But we keep praying like Christ follows me. And Christ is my assistant. Christ is just a glorified AI. And he just comes and helps me out. But I'm the captain of the ship and I steer. Here's what Ruth says. I just follow. And I give up every single one of my experiences. I give up every single one of my circumstances. I give up every single one of my situations. I do not have a say anymore. Wherever Jesus takes my mother-in-law, he takes me. We often view life as a series of strategic plans instead of the journey that God has set before us for us to walk in. We need to be careful. And what Ruth reminds us is, you want to be a godly person, and especially a godly woman, commitment means your entire existence. And what does that mean? You lost your opportunity to have a say. You lost your opportunity to have a say. You surrender that at the door. And the extent of that loss of opportunity to have a say, to have a choice, so to speak, that entails endurance. And notice the next phrase. How far will Ruth go in going where Naomi goes? What does Ruth say? Next phrase. Where you lodge, I will what? Lodge. The word lodge means to spend the night. To spend the night. And you think about spending the night somewhere. That's a sacrifice. That's a sacrifice, you say. Are you sure? Yeah. There's a whole industry based upon this reality. It's called Yelp. It's called Expedia. It's called all the websites. Now think about this with me. That rate hotels. Why do you need to rate a hotel? Because you're worried about where you're going to spend the night. And then it's not good enough just to have a rating system for hotels. 3-star hotel, 4-star hotel, 5-star hotel, 0-star hotel. Then you have people who write reviews and ratings of the hotel. Yes? It's not like, oh, this is a 5-star hotel. It's okay. No, then you start reading the reviews of whether it's really a 5-star hotel. They have to rate the ratings. And then you have to rate the raters of the ratings. It just keeps going on forever. And it's all because we're desperate to know where we're going to put our head down at night. Because I don't like to put someplace where it's not dirty, not comfortable, not safe. We understand that. We don't want to sacrifice that far. And I completely resonate with it. I support that entire industry. But that proves what Ruth did there. She said, Naomi, it may mean that we have to go through danger at night. It may mean that there's going to be risk. It may mean that there's going to be discomfort. It may mean that it gets dirty. It's okay. I'm with you all the way. Commitment to Christ doesn't just stop because it ruins our convenience or it ruins our perfect plans or it disrupts our sense of risk or sacrifice. Ruth demonstrates, I understand what commitment means. It means all of my existence, and there are no exceptions to that. Where you lodge, I will lodge. I'm not going to abandon this when the going gets tough. There is amazing endurance. But it's not just all existence is committed to God. It's not just all endurance is committed to God. It's this. It's exclusive. It's exclusive. This is astounding. Your people shall be what? My people. Now, there's two sides to this coin. On the one hand, being part of a new people, just any kind of new people, new culture, can be tough. New language, new practices, new calendar, new friends, new everything. Everything is new. Everything is different. Everything is alternate. And brothers and sisters, that is the nature of the Christian life if you stop and think about it. It's a new calendar. It's a new week. It's a new set of friends. It's a new culture. It's a new mentality. It's a new way of life. It's a new practice. It's new and different everything. That's one side of the coin. And that already would be all difficult. That's why people say, I have culture shock. Because it's so disruptive to them. They can't handle it. But that's just one side of the coin. Your people will be my people. What has Ruth basically declared? I won't have my own people anymore. Ruth was a Moabitess. They had a life. She had a family. She had a heritage. She had friends. She had a way of doing things. And at this moment, what Ruth basically does is renounced everything around her and turned to one new people, the people of God, the people of Israel. That's a feat. You know, in our culture, even today, people still want to cling to their past and remain a Christian. They do it all the time. That's this whole identity thing. I'm not just a Christian. I'm an African-American Christian. I'm an Asian Christian. I'm a white Christian. I'm a whatever, whatever Christian. Same-sex attracted Christian. They just put all these terms in there because they want to retain what is old. Ruth would have rebuked every single one of them and said, no, that's not how this works. That people is now what? Your people. You make a clean break of it all. It doesn't mean that you don't have any friends anymore or you can't celebrate some things. No, that's not what we're talking about. What we are talking about, though, is who you are. Who you are and your alliances and who defines you and what determines you and what binds you. You have to make a clean break. That is what Ruth did at this moment. Think of it this way. There is a side that we just said that wants to retain the old, but there's an equal side that hates embracing the new. They say things like, well, I love Jesus, but I don't love the church. I love Jesus, but I don't like organized religion. What would Ruth say? No. It's not my people are my people. It's your people are my people. And when you have that, you realize this. Christianity isn't just take Jesus as an add-on to your life. He's not just some accoutrement. He's not just some ornament that just you can assemble him as one compartment of many in your existence. It's all or nothing. It's all or nothing. And you have completely re-identified yourself, your allegiances, your definitions, your determiners, your relationships. Everything is dictated by something new. Your people are my people. And that's what Ruth said. And that's massive to say. That's massive to say. And how do we know Ruth meant it? Because she never went home. She never went home. She said, we're going that way to Israel. And my back is to my family. I'm not going. That's no longer my home. I'm going home. That is profound. And so commitment. You want to know, understand commitment? It is your existence. It's with endurance. It is exclusive. And here it is. It's extreme. It's extreme. Notice verse 17. Where you die, I will what? Die. That is the furthest extremity of existence because it's not just life, but it's all the way till you what? Die. That is the most extreme endurance. Why? Because there might be nothing more painful and nothing more difficult than what? Death. And Ruth said, I'll go all the way. Often in our own hearts, and I understand this, I resonate with this, I empathize with this, we sometimes wonder when persecution comes, will we just not break? When persecution comes, will we just be able to survive and be faithful in those extreme conditions? We ask a question. Ruth never asked the question. She only gave the answer. She says, where you die, that's it. She had total determination. She knew what the cost was, and she embraced it because that's what true commitment to God looks like. And not only is it exclusive, not only is it existence and enduring and extreme, here's another one. It is everlasting. This is very fascinating. Notice the next phrase of verse 17, and there I will be what? Buried. You might think about it. Ruth could have said to Naomi, look, when you're dead, I'm going home. I already got, like, you're a bitter woman. It's already hard enough. I think God will understand my sacrifice, and afterwards, I'm going back to my own country, and no one's going to hold that against me, because the only last anchor that would be here would be you, and you're gone, and you won't even know, you won't even mind, so I'm heading home. There I will be buried. What did Ruth understand? When you commit to God, there is no turning back. There is no turning back. This is who you are going to be forever. You are not going to be known by any other identity. You are not going to be known by any other people. You are not going to be known by any other place. You are not going to be known by any other thing. There is no option to go back. That option is not an option. It is not thinkable. It is inconceivable in that regard. Ruth knew this is a once and for all decision. And I'm not turning around. I'm not turning around. Brothers and sisters, we talk all the time about commitment. We talk all the time about commitment. Do we really understand what it means? Ruth did. Why is Ruth talking about such existence and such an endurance and such exclusivity and such extremity and such an everlasting decision? Because it's all an expression of this. What does it mean that your God will be what? My God. She has explained it. I dedicate everything in my life. I dedicate my entire experience. I dedicate that there are no exceptions. I dedicate all of that to God because He is my God. And notice how serious and how earnest she is. Notice she says, God, my God, in verse 16. But then in the very next verse, when she makes the commitment, whose name does she start to say in verse 17? Thus may Yahweh do to me. Immediately, she adopts the name of the God of Israel. Immediately, she makes the change, and it's so extensive, and it's so gripping, even her speech changes instantaneously. Because that is the level of commitment she has. From the inside out, every single thing and every single word now is dedicated to Him. That's the commitment level she has. We keep saying we want to be committed to Christ. But how often is it that we just want Christ to be committed to us? Commitment to Christ means your entire existence, all your endurance, it's exclusive, it's eternal, it's extreme, and it's all an expression of this, that you love Him. That's real commitment. And by the way, I think most issues and most questions about being a biblical man or a biblical woman are resolved right here. Right here. If you have this kind of commitment to the Lord, everything just kind of falls into place. There's really not much to discuss afterwards. And indeed, that's the case. That's why it's in Ruth chapter 1. Everything flows from here. Everything flows from here. You want to be a committed person to God? Follow Ruth. And therefore, if you want to be a godly woman, that's the commitment you need. A godly woman is so committed to the Lord. Well, she's not just committed to the Lord. Second of all, she's conscientious. Conscientious. Look at chapter 2. Chapter 2. And there's just a lot to observe about Ruth. She's conscientious. She works hard. For one, she's proactive. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi. Naomi doesn't have to give Ruth any instruction. Naomi doesn't have to tell Ruth what to do. Naomi's so bitter she wouldn't do that anyways. More on that in a second. But Ruth says to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one whom I may find favor in his eyes. Ruth takes the initiative. Ruth figures out what to do, and she wants to do it, and she asks permission to do it. She does everything and every single step correctly, and even more than this, this is important. No work is beneath Ruth. No work is beneath Ruth. Gleaning, in a way, this is the act where a woman comes behind the harvesters, and there are other women who come and gather after the harvesters, and then a gleaner comes after those people and picks up the scraps. You only do that if you're really poor. And yeah, you're supposed to save things for those people, for Israel, but it's shameful to be out there doing that because you have to admit that your family's not doing well, and you have to take the most menial labor to do it. Ruth says, I don't care. She takes the initiative, and no work is beneath her. No work is beneath her. That's a godly woman. And she doesn't just have proactivity, she's persistent. You say, why do you mean she's persistent? Because she does this in spite of opposition. It's already hard enough to take menial work. But then when people are so discouraging, you could just say, I give up. Notice what Naomi says to Ruth. She doesn't say, thank you for your sacrifice. That's so lovely. Please, may the Lord be with you. She just says, go, my daughter. Get out of here. Do it. And you say, well, maybe this is the way you address her. No, no, no. Look at the end of chapter 2, post-Boaz. Boaz is a change maker. When Boaz turns to the scene, then he starts talking about. Then she says, may he be blessed of Yahweh, verse 20, who has not forsaken his loving kindness to the living and to the dead. This man is our relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemer. Naomi says, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women so that others do not oppress you in other fields. Now she becomes talkative. Before Boaz, it's like two words in Hebrew. That's it. Then she starts talking. And if I was Ruth, I'm like, I'm already going out of my way to help you, you bitter woman. Like, maybe I'm just going to get less grain. So one of us is going to starve. That'll teach you. Yeah. I mean, Naomi is the woman who says, I love this. This is so funny, but it's so bad. But Naomi is the one who says, I went out full and I came back empty. Who's standing next to her? Ruth. If I was Ruth, I'd be like, excuse me. Hello. I'm here. What am I to you? Ruth is Naomi's nothing. That's what it is. Naomi is bitter. Naomi is Mara, for sure. And Ruth doesn't care. She just keeps going. She doesn't care when the young man, verse 6, in charge of the reapers says, this is just so great, more on this next week. She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the fields of Moab. I wonder where she's from. Do you want to say that word one more time? Moab? I mean, come on. This man, he despises Ruth because she's from the land of what? Moab. It's obvious. It's just dripping off of his tongue. He can't get enough of it. Every opportunity, he's going to derate her. And Ruth doesn't care. You see, Ruth is a hard worker. She's conscientious. She's proactive, and she's persistent, and she practices what she says. She actually goes. Verse 3, so she went and she came and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And not only does she practice what she does so with perseverance. Just to help you understand, gleaning, you don't have any tools. It's quite literally back-breaking work because you're bent over just gathering things this whole time and holding for yourself a tremendous amount of grain. And this goes as long as you want to go. This continues as long as you are willing to glean behind those individuals. And how long does Ruth go? Well, we know that she went out in the morning, and we know that she gleaned till about lunch because it says that she was there around lunchtime. And then if you look later on in chapter 2, it says that she gleaned until evening. She gleaned the field until evening, verse 17. So most people estimate that she was out there minimum 12 hours working. 12 hours working, back-breaking, demeaning work, people making fun of her, and her own mother-in-law not even appreciating it. She still worked anyways. That's perseverance. That's perseverance. Brothers and sisters, we live in an age where people like to look as if they're busy. They take a picture of themselves and say, I'm busy. And it's not just that people like to look like they're busy. Some people, all they do is just look. They just look at people being busy, and that's what they're busy with. A godly woman is one who works hard, who really works hard, who doesn't need to be told what to do. She knows exactly what to do. She does it with perseverance. She does it persistently, even though sometimes people aren't grateful. And she practices it. She doesn't just have a good plan. She just does it. She just does it. And the world, our world, won't ever understand that. because they're too busy taking pictures of themselves. And back then, they didn't understand it either. The young man of Boaz, he'll be taught a lesson, that's next week. But the young man of Boaz, he didn't understand it. He was making fun of her the whole time. But Boaz understood. What does Boaz say to her? Verse 12, may Yahweh fully repay your work, and may your wages be full from Yahweh. Society will never understand the ethic of hard work. Our God does, though. Our God does. He grasps it. He gets it. Brothers, if you know a woman who works hard, society will never congratulate her. She's too busy to post it on social media. You congratulate her. You say what Boaz says. May Yahweh fully repay your work. Because I know that that's what God loves, and I so treasure that in your life. Because a godly woman is a conscientious woman, even as she's committed to Christ. Here's a third one. A godly woman cherishes family, chapter 3. Chapter 3. This really is a remarkable chapter where Ruth is pursuing Boaz. And there's a lot to talk about here about what Ruth did. And let me just kind of walk us a little bit backwards through the text so you see what's driving everything. But here is Boaz's reaction to what Ruth does as she pursues him. He says, may you be blessed. You have shown me, verse 10, your loving kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. What Boaz recognized in Ruth is that Ruth didn't look on the outside. She didn't care. Her love was not conditioned on whether he was the young guy, the strong guy, or whether he was poor or rich. Maybe he's the lost cause and you go for him. Or maybe he's the rich guy who can give you advantage. She had a totally different perspective, driven by something else. And along that line, she didn't just have a totally different perspective. She had a passion. She had a passion. And you say, how do you know that? Because notice what Naomi counsels Ruth to do. She says, make yourself attractive, presentable, and available. You say, what? Are you sure about that, Chow? Look at verse 3 of chapter 3. Look at what Naomi all of a sudden activates. She stops being bitter. And she says, wash yourself, anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes. Why those three things? Wash yourself makes you presentable. Anoint yourself makes you beautiful. And put on your best clothes, what does that mean? Ruth is currently wearing the clothes that of widowhood that announce, I'm not available. I might be a beautiful woman, but I'm still mourning my husband. What does Naomi say? Take those clothes off and put on clothes that say, I'm an available woman. That's what this is all about. I'm a beautiful, available woman. And so part of marital love and pursuit of it is that passion, but it's also purity. Notice this. She makes herself available. She makes herself beautiful. She makes herself presentable. But she says this, do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. This is crucial. She's not to just flaunt that in front of all those men. She has to be very careful. She's kind of like a secret agent. She has to hide herself until the right time. Why? Because while there is passion, there is always purity. That beauty is reserved for one person. One person. And then she does all of this, and I love this, just to make a proposal. And what is the nature of this proposal? It is this, that she would lie at his feet, verse 8. And you say, what does it mean to lie at somebody's feet? Well, in one context, lying at somebody's feet means you're conquered. He won. This isn't the exact same thing, but here's what Ruth is saying. I submit to you. I want to submit to you. I want to be under you. I want to be under your leadership. This is fascinating. You know, at the university, I deal with lots of people who want to figure out dating. And they asked me all kinds of questions. You know, one guy said, I don't think I can marry this girl because our sins aren't compatible. I said, what does that mean? What do you want to be, Bonnie and Clyde? You want your sins to come together and do crime together? What do you mean? Sins not compatible. Another person said, I'm just not 100% satisfied in her beauty, only 99.9. I said, did you tell her that? And another person said to me, I kid you not, Chow, we just have to care about what's on the inside. I said, okay. So I found the ugliest person I ever could find. I said, did you tell her that? All of those are problems because all people are looking out is the outside, is the outside. And along that line, they're just looking at somebody to make, to be fit for them. That's all they're looking at. It's just selfishness. And this is exacerbated by the internet. You have Match.com or whatever, has 719 levels of compatibility. What? 719? I can't even count that many. I can't even count that high, period. But, I mean, 719 levels of compatibility? That's some very complex algorithm. Here's Ruth. Ruth has one. Can I submit to that man? Not, is he good enough for me? Can I submit to that man?